Welcome to the Third Court of Appeals, or should I say, thank you for having us here in St. Angelo. It's nice to be here this morning and to see all of you. We have a second case for the second panel here this morning, and I believe if you were here for the first, you heard, but we have our recording equipment. The proceedings will be recorded, and you'll be able to look on the court's website for the audio recording of the case. For those of you who may be new to the Third Court, each side is allowed 20 minutes to argue. I take it that you've gotten with the clerk and divided up your time. We do not have our normal lighting system, so the clerk will hold up a 2-minute warning and then a red stop for you. And if we get tired of you talking, we'll let you know as well. So with that, I will call for announcements in our case this morning. Tom Merrick versus R.L. Lehrer, cause number 17509CV.
Hi, Carly Nicole for appellant Tom Merrick.
Tell me your last name.
Poll, P-O-L-L.
Great, thank you, ma'am.
Good morning, Your Honor. Richard Miller for R.L. Lehrer.
Good morning, Mr. Miller. By way of housekeeping, if anyone in the audience has a cell phone, pager, or other device that may go off, now would be a good time to shut it off. And with that, we will hear from you, Ms. Paul.
May it please the court. This case involves a cattle grazing lease dispute. The plaintiff, Mr. Lehrer, sold his property to my client, Mr. Merrick, on August 21st, 2014. The contract contained an addendum about Lehrer being able to lease the property back for grazing for 5 years. The jury found that constituted a contract. It was a lease. That was within the jury's purview, and we're not here to challenge that. We're here for two reasons. First, the trial court allowed a textbook contract dispute to morph into a DDPA case, resulting in punishment damages of $50,000 against my client. Second, the trial court allowed Lehrer to recover almost $50,000 in actual damages, despite no evidence that the breach of the lease caused these damages. Starting with the first of these issues, the DTPA damages in this case are improper because the evidence does not demonstrate this is one of the rare cases where you can get DTPA damages related to a breach of contract, and two, because there's no evidence to support the jury's DTPA findings.
How do you get around those jury findings? That's where it seems like your case really gets steep uphill. I mean, they made some very specific findings about violations on the DTPA that seem to take this away from being a normal contract case.
Well, Your Honor, if you will take a look at the actual jury questions, aside from the... Aside from the actual findings about conduct in both of these questions, you will see that they require that the evidence show that Mr. Lehrer relied to his detriment on this conduct. And in Mr. Lehrer's brief, they cite four things that they say support these jury findings. Regardless of whether these things are true or not, there's no connection between this and the damages that the jury awarded. The four things that they cite is criminally altering a legal document and using as grounds for eviction. And this was a hotly contested issue at trial, that the jury made an implicit finding that my client had added some language to a receipt. But this is not something Lehrer ever saw. He certainly couldn't have relied upon it. The next thing is using the authority of a deceptively obtained deed to evict Lehrer in violation of Property Code 93.002. I'm not familiar with that provision because it was never mentioned at trial. It's not part of the claims, it's not part of the pleadings, and it's not part of the damages. So, again, there's no way to show that
But going back to the receipt for a second, we have to credit the jury's finding.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
That happened. But why doesn't altering a receipt, assuming that that happened, to put terms in that favor Mr. Merrick, why doesn't that go towards showing intent relating back to the initial transaction?
It does not show intent because you can't look at it in isolation. City of Keller, and this is part of the exhibit that I filed with the court, talks about the importance of looking at evidence and findings and viewing them in a light most favorable to the jury, taking the jury's credibility determinations as true, but you cannot take evidence out of context in a way that makes it seem to support a verdict when it never did. All of the indications, and I'm talking about undisputed evidence now, you look at all of the evidence for the no intent to perform when the contract was made. The undisputed evidence is nobody thought at the time the contract was signed that there was a lease. And I mean, nobody could dispute this. We've got pre-closing, we've got emails between the parties and their lawyers talking about different lease drafts that they're gonna do, fix them up like you want them. The title company referring to a lease as a separate closing document. You've got emails from Mrs. Merrick forwarding to Mr. Lair's attorney a more, you know, extensive lease. All of this was supposed to get worked out as a separate lease at closing.
What do we do with the jury's answer to that question number four, though, where they seem to think that, you know, the few provisions that were in the closing documents were sufficient to form a lease?
Absolutely, and we do not challenge that. But this goes to another very specific point. The state of mind of my client on August 21st, when everybody was still talking about negotiating a lease, and the only reason it hadn't been done that day was because, unfortunately, Mr. Lair's attorney was called away at the last minute. The lease, there was a draft of another lease discussed. Mr. Lair never said, oh no, wait, we're not gonna have another lease. This is the lease here. So it's fine that the jury found that that language was sufficient, but you have to look at the course of conduct of the parties when you're looking at my client's intent on the date that contract was signed. And when you look at from...
But doesn't that cut both directions? I mean, it seems like the argument you're making is that this is really a breach of contract case, not a DTPA case, but if the argument is, look, there was never really a lease, then what's breached?
That's not my argument.
Okay.
The jury found that there was a lease. That is different. The jury did not find that the parties thought that was a lease. That was not the question in this case. Once the jury found that that constituted a lease, removing the cattle off the property was a breach of that. And that's the damages that were sought in this case. But you look at closing, they're talking about having another one. You look at during the 4 months after closing, nobody disputed that the parties continued to have these conversations. My client was saying, we need a lease, we don't have a lease yet. And no evidence contradicted his testimony that he was complaining about the very things that he said needed to be in a lease. Overstocking the property, not having insurance, the exact same things that he required in his hunting leases. So my point is you can't ignore all of that contextual evidence. To say that on the day that contract was signed, my client had a nefarious intent to never comply with it, which is what you would have to find. You would have to find altering a release, a receipt later showed that. And in fact, if you look at the three cases that Mr. Lair relies upon, it's Tony Gullo, I can't pronounce it.
Gullo.
Mm-hmm. One of the other ones, but it's Percival Tours and Green. And These are cited for the proposition that even if you only have a breach of contract, there are times that if you could show intent at the time of contracting to never comply with that contract, you might have a DTPA case. All three of these had jury findings that dealt with the defendant's state of mind at the time of contracting. It was fraudulent inducement. Tony Gillo, they talk about classic bait and switch. And there was a fraud finding in that case. The Percival Tours case, fraudulent misrepresentation case. So one of the things the jury found was that there was fraudulent inducement, which an element of is the person doesn't intend to comply with the contract. And it was the same in Green.
Is there some point at which the intent to include a whole lot of other provisions and things makes it to where he's essentially not agreeing to comply with the contract as written? I mean, if your client is intending that the lease is going to be some other thing than clearly what was written in the document, does that rise to the level of him having no intent to comply with what's in the closing?
Absolutely not, because if you look at all of the undisputed evidence in context and the light most favorable to the plaintiff, you still don't have evidence that my client's state of mind on August 21st, when they were at closing, saying, oh, we're sorry your lawyer's not here, we'll get together and iron this out later, that he thought that was a contract and that he had an intent to never comply with it.
Is the standard slight circumstantial evidence, or am I mistaken on that?
It is slight circumstantial evidence, but that has to be read in light of the Supreme Court's admonishment that you have to take all the evidence in context. So you can't just pick one thing out and say, well, this might look bad. You have to look at the entire context and course of conduct. So what makes this case different than the three cases, the only three cases that the plaintiff relies upon, is the jury was entitled to find that there was a contract. The jury was entitled to find that the DTPA was violated. And the jury was entitled to find contract damages. But because of those findings, it's this court's responsibility as a matter of law to ascertain if the plaintiff made a sufficient case for transforming the breach of contract claim into a DTPA case. So this is very different than these other cases where we have a jury finding there was no intent at the time. The jury here didn't make any determinations about what Mr. Merrick's intent was when they were sitting there. And in fact, they couldn't have, on this evidence, found that he didn't have an intent to comply with it at closing.
You mentioned looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. At some point, do we also have to look at it in the light most favorable to the verdict? I mean, what
yes,
is the standard
absolutely.
We apply here?
I'm not disagreeing with that, but you still cannot let a DTPA claim go forward in a breach of contract case where the damages sought and the injury to be remedied is breach of that contract. And there are plenty of cases out there trying it, and it is a very rare case that meets that threshold without like findings from a jury. But nobody brought a fraudulent intent.
How would he have recovered for the loss of his calves under a breach of contract theory?
He didn't seek to recover for loss of cows.
I thought there was a loss of property included.
No, that showed up in the appellate brief. It was not in the pleading. It was not sought as damages.
Lost profits weren't sought as damages?
I'm sorry?
Lost profits were not sought as damages?
Oh, they were.
But doesn't that include the loss of calves, the loss of profits?
No, none of the analysis by the expert that dealt with, I mean, certainly there was testimony of it, but it was not pleaded as a basis for recovery. And it was not included in the damage model that he recovered under.
I was going to ask you on the damages and lost profits. One of the arguments y'all make is that they should have gone and found other pasture land for the cattle.
I'm sorry?
One of the arguments y'all make on lost profits is they should have gone and found other pasture land for the cattle. Why isn't that not a causation argument, but why isn't that a mitigation of damages argument? Seems to me that that's a defensive argument, not a causation argument.
Well, Your Honor, the causation argument we're making is we have an expert who, it's Mr. Joe Ellis, and the plaintiff spent a lot of time talking about his qualifications, which we have not challenged.
Right.
But he did a damage model based on 19 cows for 5 years on Mr. Merrick's property. What we know is, and that is based on, okay, if poof, like the day that the lease went into effect, the 19 cows just disappeared. It doesn't take into account the realities and the underlying facts that are actually the case. And so.
I'm sorry, here, I warn you all. I'm sure that's very important.
Hey, I did that in a jury argument one time, so I can't cast stones.
Anyway, I'm about out.
She gets an extra minute.
Yeah, extra minute in there.
You don't have to look at the red card. You see the red on my face.
Once the evidence was interjected into trial that the 19 cows that were moved were not in fact sold, Mr. Lear brought into the case the notion that his whole business is what he was looking at. He decided to keep those young cows. He sold some old ones. He didn't sell 19. And his brief states, and I'll quote, he had a specific plan for the property at issue, namely he was planning to wind down his ranching operations and wanted to live off the interest on, you know, Mr. Merrick's land.
You can finish your thought.
Okay, thank you. Anyway, he can't have it both ways. He cannot say, well, I'm entitled to talk about selling some here, some there, but then say you can't look outside my expert's opinion that only deal with these 19 cattle.
And are we on sufficiency grounds once we get into that questioning of the damages?
Really, it's a causation argument.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Paul. Mr. Miller, I've got my phone turned off and we are ready for you.
I'm ready to go. I hope I don't have my phone. This is one courthouse. They take them up the door.
May it
please the court. My name is Richard Miller from the St. Saba County Bar, and I'm here on behalf of R.L. Lear, the appellee in this case. We're glad to argue this kind of case in San Angelo. It's an appropriate place to argue a cattle case. We look at the West as a place where a man's word is his bond, and we idealize that. We also see the West as a place where miscreants are dealt with harshly, and we hope that those principles apply in this case.
We couldn't find a sheep case.
Well, I've had those in front of you, too. In listening to the appellant's argument, I think I hear they say there's no causation because there's no harm that Mr. Lear lost this lease. And I think back at some enlightened cattlemen that have made the statement that we are really in the business of growing forage and grass, which is converted to beef and then sold as our ultimate product. But what we're really doing is producing forage. And without 257 and a half acres to produce forage in this case, of good land, Mr. Lear's cattle operation had been harmed. And it's just a simple cause and effect situation. It couldn't be simpler. He had his cattle out there. He had plans for keeping them there for 5 years and operating them as Mr. Ellis, the expert, testified to. And he was evicted. He was actually evicted from 253 acres and constructively evicted from the 4-acre turnip patch when Mr. Lear locked the gate, didn't have enough water for them, had them in freezing temperatures, and Mr. Lear had to move them. We had to get an injunction to get them moved, but he had to move the cattle because the situation on the ranch was so unbearable that he could not remain there. And so he left the lease, he lost money because of it, and we proved how much money he lost. So that's basically our case. I would like to go down the points in the appellant's brief and just talk about them briefly. But first of all, we got an objection that the evidence does not prove that Mr. Merrick intended to abide by, intended to breach the 5-year promise of a lease at the time he made the representation. There's two times he made a representation that Mr. Lear would get a 5-year lease in writing, and those are in evidence. And the first one is in the contract that he signed, and the only way you can prove that he knew at that time he was not going to abide by the 5-year lease is to look at past at the actions that occurred after that. And that Percival Tours case by the Supreme Court says you can do that. The second time he made the representation that there would be a 5-year lease, there is more evidence that we can look at that is contemporaneous. And the second time he made that representation was at the closing when Mr. Lear had a lease that tracked the contract. Mr. Merrick said there's no way in Hades he's going to sign that lease. And Mr. Merrick was holding in his hand at the time he made the representation that Mr. Lear would get a 5-year lease, he was holding in his hand a 1-year lease with a 90-day termination option at his will. And that shows a little bit of intent that he did not intend to comply with his promise to execute a 5-year lease. Then, two other leases were prepared after that, and those two leases were for 1-year terms as well. One of them had a 30-day termination option. There's no evidence that it was ever even presented to Mr. Lear, and Mr. Merrick couldn't remember the circumstances of why it was prepared. And then the next lease that was prepared had a 7-day termination option, and it was a 1-year lease. Mr. Merrick presented it to Mr. Lear out in the pasture. At the same time, he presented this acknowledgement that he received a interest check with the credit for the lease payment on it. And of course, that is another situation where we think the evidence shows Mr. Lear guilty of very deceptive conduct in adding language at the bottom.
Mr. Merrick, what is the significance of the finding that Mr. Merrick, or we assume the jury found that Mr. Merrick added that language? What's the significance of it for showing intent?
And I'd like to take that a little bit further. Sure. Showing intent at the time of the formation of the original contract in August. How do we get there?
Here's how we get there.
If that's okay, Judge.
Yeah, that's perfect.
It's a pattern of conduct. First of all, at the time he made the representation that I'm going to give you, this will survive closing and we'll do a 5-year lease later, he's holding a 1-year lease. Then his ex-wife prepares another lease that has another 1-year lease and has a termination option. I don't know if that was ever given to Mr. Lear. The evidence is it was not. And then a third lease is prepared. All of these things show a pattern of conduct, an intent to never give the lease. And the forged part of the document, the acknowledgement, which no one would sign in their right mind, shows the extent that he would go to in order to not give a five-year lease. And if you read that language at the bottom of the receipt, it says, if the parties do not enter into a mutually acceptable lease, which requires both parties coming together, one party could withhold his acceptance and it wouldn't be mutual to any kind of a lease, then Lear's got 5 days to get his catalog. And who would sign such a thing? That is overbearing in itself. Plus, the representation was made at the time by Mr. Merrick. This is just an acknowledgement that you received the check. And then in the recorded call to the sheriff's office, which is exhibit number 26 typed up, I would encourage the court to look at exhibit 26. Lear says, well, I had to wave some money in front of his face to get him to sign it. He might not even realize that it's even on there, but he's agreed to get his cattle off in 5 days, and the sheriff need to come out here and help me get him off and file him for trespassing. So, I mean, the deceptive intent that the jury found and had every reason to find is there. So how does that relate to causation? I think might be one of the court's questions. And if you read Mr. Merrick's testimony, I think that is on page 43 and 44 of volume 5 of the reporter's record. He says that was one of the bases on which he locked Mr. Lear out and put his cattle in the 4-acre turnip patch, that he used that acknowledgement as a basis for his action in evicting Mr. Lear. So definitely there's causation there. Definitely that relates to the deceptive trade practice. He represented a legal document that had characteristics which it did not. This is just an acknowledgement, not a not something I can kick you off the land with it later on. So,
to the extent of the DTPA, you have the fraud inducing Mr. Lear to do something. At what points do we have inducement? I mean, we've talked a little about the point at which they actually contracted on land. Are there other points of inducement that you all are claiming support the verdict?
Well, the inducement was that Mr. Lear wanted to sell his land but still run cattle on it for 5 years. And so he was looking for a buyer that would let him do that. He gave good terms. He was, I think, 69 years old at the time. He hadn't planned out what his retirement was. He testified, well, I don't have no kids and I don't have brothers and sisters. I'm the only child, and I thought I'd just sell some of my land so I could have some money in my retirement to do a lot of the things that I wanted to do when I can retire and that I've always wanted to do. And so, but I've got about 5 good years left in me, so I want a 5-year lease and start working on the retirement plan. And he found a man who said, yes, I'll let you lease that land, and promised that he would let him lease it for the 5 years. And this is very handy as opposed to some of his other leases to his home place. It's just a half mile down the road from where he lives. He can check on his cattle easily, and it was a very attractive thing for him to get the 5-year lease. So the promise of a 5-year lease was inducement for him to give a deed to his property that had been in the family a long time. And then the inducement to sign the acknowledgement was simply handing a cashier's check for $11,500, and I need proof that you received it. Well, sure, I think that's reasonable. You ought to have proof that I received the cashier's check. And he signed it. But little did he know that there would be language added to the end, and And that would be used as the basis of kicking him off the place. So, I think the pattern of conduct, when compared to the three cases we cited, shows an intent never to abide by that five-year lease, that we're not going to do it. We're going to put a notwithstanding anything else contained here in the contrary. I can cancel this lease in 90 days, 30 days, and eventually down to 7 days. That's pretty conscious intent when you start changing those figures each time. They like to bring up the template defense, as I call it, that, well, Ms. Merrick worked in a law firm and she just got these leases from the office computer. And even though it's an oxymoron that it shows a term but then has a cancellation period, a five-year lease with a seven-day cancellation period is an oxymoron. It's a seven-day lease. And she just says, we got those from the office. I changed the names and put the term and put the amount of the lease, but evidently didn't read the rest of it. It was pretty hard for the jury to believe, I think, that she evidently has, her law firm has a trove of oxymoronic leases that she could just pull out any time and send off for Mr. Lear to sign while her husband thinks he's illiterate. Pretty compelling evidence, I think, for the jury. Anyway.
How are the damages different? I'd asked a question about the lost calves, and Ms. Pohl said they weren't included. Is there a difference in the damages sought here than would be in a normal breach of contract case?
Actually, the lost profits would be the same for breach of contract and DTPA. Now, the appellants argue that if the damages are the same, you can't use DTPA. But the appellant doesn't find any support in the law for that. And in fact, it's a timely question because I was about to tell you about Justice Reveley's opinion in McCraig versus Wells Fargo Bank, 788 Federal 3rd, 463. And in that case, there was a suit against the bank, and there was also for breach of contract on a loan agreement, and then there was also a violation of the Fair Debt Collection Act, which I think can be used as a basis for a DTPA claim. And Justice Reveley talks about the Crawford case and the Ashford case, and says that the Texas Supreme Court has never held that underlying conduct that breaches an agreement cannot violate the DTPA merely because it also breaches an existing contractual obligation. Put differently, if a particular duty is defined both in contract and in a statutory provision, and a party violates the duty enumerated in both sources, the economic loss rule does not apply. And cites Formosa Plastics. So realize it's the same conduct, says that Formosa realizes that under certain circumstances, limited circumstances, that conduct can give rise to both tort and breach of contract. So nothing that the appellant has found is that if the damages are the same, you have to go contract. It relies on what the actions were that the cause of action is based on. Is it based on contract? Is it based on deceptive acts? So we say deceptive acts are not ever intended to sign. After the contract was made, going out and getting this acknowledgement signed, being deceptive after that, submitting deceptive leases after that, that didn't comport with the contract, and acting unconscionably. And of course, I think forging a release is pretty unconscionable. You wonder how that fits the definition, the difference in a party's capacity. Because he had a deed, Mr. Merrick was in a capacity as the landlord and the owner of the property. He could say, don't come on my property, you're trespassing. He had that capacity. He also had the capacity as the holder of the acknowledgement, which he could take and type extra language in down below the signature line. So that's how we fit under that unconscionability definition. I would like to talk a little bit about lost profits damages and talk about a case that maybe we didn't talk about enough. It was not in the appellant's brief at all. In the appellee's brief, we cited it and talked about it, but after preparing for this argument and reading the briefs in the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals decision and all this, there are some really good things in the Swinia case. It's the leading case, and it allowed damages. And how it fits in this is that Swinia had lots of customers, just like Mr. Lear had lots of leases. He had five or six leases. They had more than two customers. And so the lost profits from one of the customers was proven. And Swinia came back in and said, oh, you have to look at the overall picture. And the court said, no, that's not right. If these are not mutually exclusive, that is, if you could have two accounts, you just have to look at that one account and see what you lost off of it. And that is a key in their argument against us that this Texas Supreme Court holds against. So I see my time is about up. It appears that the jury saw this case for what it was. They awarded damages. It's not the kind of great, huge damages that should cause any court to rend their garments. And it is a case that should be affirmed because justice was done. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Rebuttal, Ms. Pohl.
May it please the court. I wanted to follow up on the very last question you asked me. I was answering a causation question, and you asked me if really this was a sufficiency. And I do want to make clear, there is no evidence to support these lost damages awards. I mean, the
lost profits?
Lost profits, I'm sorry. The plaintiff even acknowledges in his brief that 19 cows were not sold. Some of the cows are different properties. I mean, we've gone through it in the brief. I just wanted to make sure.
But there's no evidence contradicting the testimony of their expert. Is that correct? You're making a strict no evidence point.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't really understand that, because my understanding is the testimony was that he was going to make $10,000 profit on this land grazing his cattle each year. And if he's then taken off of that land where he's supposed to make $10,000 a year each year, why isn't that evidence of lost profits in and of itself?
Because, Your Honor, we would argue that the Holt case, the Supreme Court Holt case, is more applicable than the one than
ERI?
I'm sorry?
ERI Swinney?
Yes.
Yeah.
In that case, it involves a bulldozer that was under warranty. It was stuck in the shop for like 8 months, so right. It couldn't be used. And the evidence was, well, we could have rented it out for this amount. And the court said, no, you need to show that with the broader context of your business that you have business and capacity to do that. In this case, it's Mr. Lear that imported evidence about these other places and his overall business. Otherwise, there would literally be no evidence, because he took the 19 cows from here and took them over here. The only way that he tried to establish any lost profits was selecting some other cows from other places to sell that didn't total 19.
So
because it's a no evidence, we also don't have to worry in your analysis about the remand versus render question that's in ERI as well. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Although the plaintiffs in their briefs said...
Because if it's sufficiency, then we would have to remand, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I definitely want to spend a minute talking about the leases, since this is what was presented as evidence of no intent at the time of contracting these various leases. So I'm going to go back to City of Keller, but this has to be taken in context.
Can I interrupt again? And I'm sorry, but if we skip intent, what about unconscionability? Because wasn't there a jury finding on that question?
There was, but there is still no evidence to demonstrate that anything that the jury found he did was unconscionable, cause that he relied on, first of all, and was the cause of the damages. The cause of the damages was breach of the lease.
So either intent or unconscionability, it boils down to damages.
Exactly.
Causation. Gotcha.
And that's with the reliance with the DTPA. Okay, so the leases in context, nobody disputes that Merrick offered up the first lease well before closing, sent it to Lair's attorney who said he was going to review it. Nobody ever mentioned the term. No one disputes that when they sat down at closing, Merrick told Lair, nothing in here is set in stone. But the things that were important to him, he talked about consistently throughout the case, like the insurance, the no overgrazing. Lair sat there at closing and went over that. Mrs. Merrick said, point out anything that you don't like or that needs to be changed. This term was never mentioned by the attorney, by Mr. Lair, never at any point while Mr. Merrick was making clear that all of these terms were negotiable and which ones were important to him, did anyone complain about this? So to come back later and say that means that on August 21st, when they were sitting there at closing, Mr. Merrick had a nefarious intent to never comply with a five-year lease is just too much of a stretch. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Pohl. Thank you both for a well-argued and interesting case. The case will be submitted and the court will stand at recess. Thank you all.